On January 19, 2022, Chinny Wenjack should have turned 67 years of age. He died in 1967 at the age of 12 after running away from a residential school in northern Ontario. He tried to walk close to 400 miles in the cold weather to get home. Chinny was a member of the Ojibwe, and he was attending the Cecil Jeffrey Residential School in Kenora, Ontario. He became lonely and he ran away. He died trying to get back to see his father. His story is heartbreaking, and it's one that Gord Downie of Tragically Hip shares in Secret Path, the beloved singer's last solo musical and video release. Downie said, "I never knew Chinny, but I will always love him. He haunts me. His story is Canada's story. We are not the country we thought we were." In his last onstage performance, he called out to Prime Minister Trudeau, who was there, to fix the problems in northern Canada, saying, "It's maybe worse than it's ever been, so it's not on the improve." According to the United Nations Index on Human Development, Quality of Life, people who live on band or reservation lands in Canada have a standard of living that is ranked 63rd in the world. The rest of Canada is ranked 6th. According to former National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Perry Bellegarde, 6th versus 63 is an enormous gap in the standard of living, and it's a gap, he says, that represents a disproportionate number of First Nations people in prisons. It represents the high youth suicide rate, which is 4 to 5 times the national average. It represents 40,000 Indigenous children in foster care, and it represents a cap on education funding that is close to half of provincial averages. Michael Downie, the Tragically Hip singer's older brother and the filmmaker who produced Secret Path, carries on the work of the foundation the two set up, the Downie Wenjack Fund. The fund calls on Canadians to build a better country and to see the people we've been trained to ignore. I invited Michael Downie to join me for a conversation that matters about the need to build awareness, to advance education, and enhance connections between all peoples in Canada. Michael Downie, welcome to this episode of Conversations That Matter that we are recording here on the traditional lands of the Coast Salish peoples. You're in from Toronto.
Correct.
To speak to this conference that is trying to understand what is the effect going to be for the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People.
Right.
Why is this topic so important to you? I know we'll get to the your film, your foundation, the work of you and your brother, but off the top, why is this so important to you?
Well, here's what I think.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, when you look at something as massive as reconciliation, something that, you know, you look at a country that has gone down one path and is now, I think, trying to move away from that and to go down a new path.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the most pressing question is how. And for me, when I started to look into when the announcement was made, you start to realize that there is a possibility that we could start with the laws of the land, and they could start to be not only the new laws, but the existing laws, and they can be reinterpreted. They can be understood through this Indigenous lens. The rights of Indigenous people can come, you know, right into the legislation and be, nation to nation, determine what is this going to be? What is the law of the land going to be?
And, mm-hmm.
you know, I think as all these things, the devil is in the details, but to me that is such a, like, it's such a big pivot to allow for a structure, a superstructure to be put in place that says, oh yeah, but there is this kind of, there's this mechanism. I think we've got some great ideas here, but let's bring in this mechanism that says we now need to understand, and we need to consult, we need consent, we need to basically be able to craft this law so that it includes UNDRIP, and that is basically. So I just think when you have something like that, for now, because, you know, I think that what can happen with this type of movement is, you know, builds up momentum, momentum dissipates. People move on. People worry about something else. I mean, a recession is a terrible thing because all of a sudden people go, oh, wait a minute, I don't want to worry about, you know, the environment, or I don't want to worry about, you know, indigenous and how they are, you know, what their prospects are and what... this kind of gets, this to me is sort of supersedes all.
So I got to hang on for a second while we take a quick commercial break.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. Okay, so something led you to that point. For me, I go, okay, let's take a look at this table. We're a couple of white guys who are, you know, over 50 probably. I can't speak for you, but I can speak for myself. And so why do I care? Like, what happened to me? Because my education did not include any of this. But I was a young reporter. I was doing research around the Gitxsan Wet'suwet'en land claim back in the late 1980s. And I went... oh my gosh, I didn't know about the Royal Proclamation of 1763. I didn't know about the Indian Act. I didn't know about the, you know, the Doctrine of Discovery. I didn't know any of these things. And I start to go, we've done something wrong in this country. And so I built from that. Was there something that happened for you that made you go, hang on a second, I've been deceived. And now I need to play my part in righting this wrong? Because that's what I see in you, that you're going, we've done something wrong, and we've got to make it right.
Stu, for me, the moment, you know, thank you. It's great to hear, you know, what it was that kind of shook you out of those not doldrums, but, you know, out of that reality.
Yeah.
And for me, I was driving my car in my neighborhood in Toronto, listening to CBC Radio, which is what I do.
Yeah.
I'm a filmmaker. I'm always kind of listening, you know, always, as I say, I always have sort of one antenna up, just sort of taking in, like, oh, that's a story I don't think I've heard before. And I hear the story of this little boy running away from his residential school. And if there was a thought bubble over my head when I heard that part, it just would have been a question mark. Like, oh, I mean, this is, I think 2012, I figured it out.
Yeah.
A question mark. Residential school. Okay. I think I know what that is, but I don't think I really know anything about that. And then what hit me over the head was this 12-year-old boy trying to walk home 600 kilometers along the tracks to a community that wasn't even on the tracks. And my son Will was 12 at the time. You know, you don't really need to be a parent to recognize, man, there's something wrong with that. How? So that, I literally turned the car around, drove back home, went online, booted up the computer, and just, you know, my jaw just kind of, as I, that question mark was erased in my thought bubble, and it became, I mean, the Truth and Reconciliation Report hadn't been finished yet. It was going across the country. I didn't know it existed. All these things I just didn't know about. And there was so much information. There were so many Cheneys that I read about that afternoon. And, you know, the next day, Gordon and I, my brother Gordon and I were having lunch. We had scheduled a lunch. We often did that and talked about projects, because we kind of had the chance to work together quite a bit over the years on different things. And I had printed up the article by Ian Adams, The Lonely Death of Charlie Wenjack. And I'd printed up a bunch of other stuff, sort of put together a little research package, you know. And I just slid the McLean's article, you know, from February 6th, 1967. I slid it across to Gordy, and I said, you got to read this. It's going to blow your mind. But that was the beginning. And I think just the idea that, you know, I think for the two of us, what happened, we didn't talk this way, but I think what happened at that lunch was that I think between the two of us, we would think, we know this country pretty well. Gordy had been touring for decades, been everywhere. Mm-hmm. I'd been making films across the country, north, south, east, west, for not quite as long, quite a while. Met a lot of people, heard mm-hmm. a lot of stories. Never heard a story like this. And I think we just felt, if this is the case between the two of us, there must be a lot of other Canadians out there that don't know jack shit about something like this.
Exactly.
Which was true. Which was true. Mm-hmm. And that started us down that path of, let's see if we can tell this story of this little boy. And maybe this one story will resonate. Maybe it'll open the door. And I have a bit of a theory that when you look at these kind of, there's so many terrible examples throughout history, but when you have these disastrous incidents with big numbers, it kind of bounces off the brain.
Yes.
You know, that number, 150,000 kids went to these schools, maybe over 5,000 died, didn't make it home. It can be kind of hard to really get a hold of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we thought maybe the story of one can kind of, you know, punch through that. And I think for many people, that's kind of what happened because, you know, it's kind of the story, the way it's presented, the music mm-hmm. kind of opens the heart a little bit. And you just need to think about one to then extrapolate. It's not very difficult to think about what happened to the thousands and the thousands right. for generation after generation. So, I mean, I even just talking to you right now about it, part of my brain is kind of like, are we really talking about this happened here in this country? Mm-hmm. We really, over my great-grandfather came here around, you know, just before the First World War. Like, these things were already in place.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents, these things were ongoing. My parents, me, my first child, I think, was maybe born just around the time they closed the last residential school. So, like part of me, it's important to talk about. It's hard to believe it actually all happened, and it absolutely did.
This is our second break. We'll be back in a moment. It's hard to talk about, too, especially when you run up against people who don't appreciate or understand the history. And this is why I think what you are doing is so vitally important. Initially, I thought, okay, well, who am I? I'm just like some older white guy talking about this. Why would it actually matter? Other than the fact that it matters to me, why would it matter to anybody else? And I was talking to the woman who heads up the inclusion program at the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University, and I said this, and she goes, no, you're exactly the person who has to be talking about this. Mm-hmm. If white men like you and me mm-hmm. aren't talking about this, then nobody else is. Mm-hmm. And we actually do have the ability to amplify this voice mm-hmm. and make a difference. And so I think the film that you have produced is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Because it reaches inside that experience and the devastation that it's had on community mm-hmm. and country, mm-hmm. Family, community, country. It's horrible. And mm-hmm. so thank you very much for making the film and for caring and for coming and talking about this.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate that, Steve.
It is extraordinary. So we're here about UNDRIP. When you hear about UNDRIP, and I appreciate when you say, I don't like that term.
It feels awkward.
Because it sounds derogatory. DRIP. But that's not its intent. But people are here today because they're trying to understand that. Mm-hmm. When you first learned about the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, did you have fear of it or did you celebrate it?
You know, the interesting thing, I'll be honest with you, and I really don't have a legal background at all. When I first heard the news, I kind of thought to myself, oh, I didn't know that you could just do that. Like, I knew that this was, we need to adopt the UN Declaration. But I realized that, as I said earlier, the devil's in the details, but I didn't realize that, like, a provincial government could just basically do that
mm-hmm.
and say, oh yeah, that's now a law, which will affect all these other laws. So I think that, like, that kind of surprised me a little bit, because I do think that You know, the issues with some of these things are that, you know, it can be very vague. There's mm-hmm. no necessarily there when we right. start to talk about, you know, the calls, which are really, really important. And a lot of people refer to them. But let's face it, this is a complicated world, and often it's sort of the steps aren't clear. Mm-hmm. And I guess the closer you are to the action, perhaps the more clear they become.
Yeah.
When I first read that, the story about what was happening in British Columbia with the UNDRIP, I kind of went, oh, I guess they just did it. Like, it's done. Now the heavy lifting starts.
Exactly.
But so that made me really, a couple things. One, I thought, where else but British Columbia? Like, absolutely, you know, in many ways, when you think about, you know, Indigenous culture, to me, British Columbia has, in many ways, I think it has the least dismantled of all the different cultures from across the country, and there's mm-hmm. obviously a few reasons of that for that. So you think, you know, already so progressive, mm-hmm. Such a part of people's lives here. I think, like, even if you're not even paying attention, it's kind of a part of your life. You know, I'm in Toronto and Ontario. I'm so shocked over the last 5 years. I've learned, like, just about every community has there is a reserve just outside mm-hmm. the community, almost no matter where you are. And but it has been something that we have ignored and there has been nothing.
It's invisible.
It's invisible. It has been invisible.
What is that wonderful line that your brother shared?
A people that we've been trained to ignore.
Yeah.
Trained to ignore. And that definitely applies. So I thought, you know, British Columbia, what a perfect launch pad for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I think it's going to have a ripple effect across the country. I really do. And I think I really believe that going forward, I think it's really going to work
mm-hmm.
because I think if we just, you know, if we just think about what's happening in Australia right now, like, clearly the, you know, has no value. Nothing has any value until you get it out of the ground.
Right.
You know, put it on a shelf. I think for this generation, and, you know, I know when you're younger, you're more idealistic. I think this generation right now is different.
Yeah.
I think they see the world differently. And I believe that, you know, the whole society is ready. You know, not everyone,
mm-hmm.
but I believe on the whole, the society is ready for a new worldview, a new way of being in the world. And to me, more that I learn about, you know, the more that I learn about Indigenous ways of seeing the world, the more I am struck by the fact that I think it's so relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
The sped up, you know, the sped up society that we're in, where we're, you know, where people are trashing each other online, and there just seems to be this breakdown,
mm-hmm.
you know, of all these different, you know, all these different parts of our you know, culture and society, and I feel like in many ways some of these ancient ideas are, I just think they're more relevant than ever, and, you know, I think many of us are kind of looking for something, you know, maybe that, you know, you said what was the reason. You know, maybe I was kind of looking for something. You know, we live in a time when, you know, fairly recently, we've moved on from, you know, in Canada, mm-hmm. the major religions, that they're not a part of our life.
Yes.
They don't sort of help us. They're there. Mm-hmm. And I think they help people at different times. But across the board, you know, we are, it's not a big part of who we think we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, and this actually happened when we were having a service for Gord, and there was no way we were going to, you know, make it as lapsed Anglicans. There was no way we were going to bring in the minister to say some, you know, we were going to talk about Gord, you know. But kind of on a whim, I invited Perry Bellegarde, like, oh, yeah. I only gave him about 24 hours notice.
Mm-hmm.
I said, because I knew that the relationship was real, and you know, when you go, when you watch that, you know, the Gordy's naming ceremony in Ottawa, that Perry Bellegarde and Donnie Spiedel and Perry's wife Val sort of, you know, organized. And
third and final break. We'll be right back.
It was really meaningful for Gord, is what I'm trying to say. And so at the, you know, I said, you know, Perry, I think you should be there. You know, we're meeting at a bar. It's just his family and friends and bandmates. And we're just going to be together. We're going to remember Gord a few days after he passed. And Perry came. And he just said, oh, by the way, since you've invited me, I have to do a few things for your brother. I'm like, so we have a smudge. I'm gonna sing a song about that's kind of a for him as he leaves.
Yeah.
And I have to do all these things. And I'm like, okay. What happened was that he introduced a spirituality to the evening that we didn't have, and it kind of it was on my mind that we wouldn't have something more formal, you know. But like I said, we couldn't, you know, would be against Gord's wishes if we were to, you know, bring in the, you know, the guy with the collar. And Perry and Val and Donnie gave us everything that we needed. They had a shawl that they brought a shawl. They wrapped Gord's kids and his ex-wife in it as they smudged them.
Wow.
This is to protect you. You're together. This is Gord. Like for me, you know, hopefully not to misinterpret, but these are the arms reaching around you. He's still here. My mother came up. They had a shawl for her. They put it around her. They smudged. And they sang. And they said, this is for when you're missing your son. You put the shawl on. And he's with you.
Wow.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, that helps. That, when I talk about relevancy, we were mourning. We were grieving.
Yeah.
The what they gave to us, and it was a gift, was so important. And everybody left that room. There were people of every walk of life in that room that night.
Yeah.
Super powerful, you name it. Everybody left with the same feeling that I'm describing right now.
Yeah.
That was something. And but you know, hey. Couple of thousand years, you learn things, right? And that's what they were giving us. That's what they were giving us.
What you this is a perfect note to end on, because it mirrors what Chief Joseph said. It allows us to embrace our common humanity.
Our common humanity. Amen.
Isn't that a wonderful thought?
For sure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stu.
Yeah, very
pleasure.
Nice to meet you.